Station number 14983, Albert Shippen, reel 4.
Another regiment, Mr. Shippen.
Yes, that's correct. The 4th IDC, as it was named at that time. The depot, the regimental depot, was actually the castle. And then we had a small ATS camp between the camp and the castle. And then the camp itself, a huge camp, it was divided into, at that time, the Dedham Light Infantry and the Duke of Wellington Regiment. They moved up from Huddersfield, and their accommodation in Huddersfield had been taken over by the ATS at the time.
Was there any rivalry between the two regiments?
No, I think that they fitted in very well because they had equivalent officers in different branches. We had a colonel of the Dedham Light Infantry, and his name was Hughie McBain. Then we had equivalent second in commands from the Duke of Wellington Regiment, company commanders in that, and equal Durham Light Infantry, and all the way through, and duties were more or less split, even instructors that took the parts. But once you'd completed in those days, you had been assigned to the Durham Light Infantry, the Duke of Wellington's, you automatically went off to their battalions after you'd finished your 13 weeks.
Was there any problems? I'm thinking in terms of the Durham Light Infantry have a very quick march, haven't they? The Duke of Wellington, is it a slower march?
Oh, yes. Well, the Durham do 140, which is Light Infantry regulation pace. 9 times out of 10, you always exaggerate that when you can. The Duke of Wellington's do 120. But, like everything else, when we used to do combined parades, the Duke of Wellington's used to march on first towards the band of bugles, and then we used to march the Durham Light Infantry on last. And the same coming off parade, the Duke of Wellington's marched off first, and then the Durham Light Infantry last.
Had they taught you the quick pace, light infantry pace, from the very beginning?
Oh, yes. It was very staunch traditionalists on both sides. I would think everyone tried to outpoint the other one by its traditions, and the Duke of Wellington Regiment obviously came from India and were connected with the Clive of India, and are very proud of the fact. And the Durham Light Infantry, of course, its quick march and being known as the Faithful Durhams, and having one of the biggest contingents of battalions in the First World War, were very proud of its history and traditions.
Can we now turn to food? We've talked about accommodation. What was the food like you were getting?
Well, the jobs that was done at the 4th IDC at one point was along came a load of people who estimated how many calories a soldier would need to do certain field exercises and to keep up his strength as infantry. As the mobile war was developing, they became more mobile, but the infantry had to keep up with them once they got out of the vehicles. So they had a team of experts, and they did how much nourishment and that a soldier would need to keep up his strength and that, to carry out the battle. Food was quite adequate, really, in all aspects. I think the thing that you've got to appreciate is the fact that you can just imagine 1,500 men in one dining hall, approximately, and the same in another dining hall. And when you cook to prepare a meal, say the breakfast, the ADS girls used to come through the guard room around about 6 in the morning, and they had to cut the bread, put the butter out, make the tea, make sure the cornflakes were available. Then if you're doing eggs and bacon for breakfast, 1,500 eggs and bacon, because there was no possibility of a soldier being late on parade and said his breakfast was late. He went without his breakfast, he had to be there on parade because of the discipline aspect. So you can just imagine. Breakfast meal was quite substantial. Then, of course, about 10 o'clock...
What would you get for breakfast?
Well, you would have a porridge and cornflakes, and then you would have egg and bacon with butter and bread, and probably a marmalade was available for you, and your tea. That would be your breakfast meal most times. There was a variation. You would probably get scrambled egg with what used to call bubble and squeak, which was like a cabbage, a dehydrated cabbage mixed with potatoes. And then you would have a boiled egg on some mornings. They tried to vary it as much as it could, but owing to the fact that the army issued rations more or less as per the schedule over and over again. It was a weekly ration schedule, and nothing changed from one week to the next.
What would you get for lunch?
Well, because the men were training, and that, it would be kind of a light soup, probably it would be cheese with pickles, with a sweet, with tea again, and bread and butter. Because in the evening, when the men had finished all their duties, they would then get a substantial meal in the evening. It consisted of probably a very kind of a thick broth, brown stew, which was a very substantial meal in itself, and then of course the usual vegetables, potatoes, cabbages, and Brussels sprouts and so forth, and then of course you would get something like steamed pudding with the custard plus your tea and your bread and your butter. Now that was the end of the army ration for the day, and that would be probably finished and over by about 6 o'clock in the evening. Then the next, if you wanted anything after that, you had to revert back to the NAFI or the Red Shield Club.
Were you paraded for meals?
9 times out of 10, yes, because going through a tight training schedule, it was important that the right people got through at the right time in every aspect, meals, bathhouse arrangement, gymnasium, schooling, aircraft recognition. You had to be there at the appointed time to make sure that the program was met in all aspects. So you were paraded to go to the cookhouse. Once you got to the cookhouse, it was your prerogative whether you went in or and had your meal or not, or whether you walked away. But you were paraded to go to the cookhouse and the meal was offered.
Could you take me from Ravalli right through an average day that you would have at the camp?
Well, Ravalli was at 6:30 every morning. The company orderly sergeants would be up and ready and properly dressed. Once we as the bugler sounded the Ravalli call at 6:30, the camp sprang into life. The lights was on in all the accommodation where the men slept, and people started to move about. The first job in most cases was to get out of bed and get down to the ablutions and get washed and shaved, because you can just imagine the number of people trying to get washed and shaved at the same time.
Did you have hot water available?
Oh yes, that was piped down from the great these huge boilers which were situated in the cookhouse.
What were the ablutions? What did they look like?
Well, all the way were hand basins, and at the side, typical army, there was a blanco room, and then at the side of that was the toilets. But for bathing and this kind of thing, all you had was a huge shower block. There was no bath, no foot baths, just a huge shower block. And then, of course, once the reveille had gone, the next thing that happened was those soldiers who were on CB for punishment, the bugle call went for 7 o'clock reveille, for defaulters to report to the guard room to be checked that they were all there. Then we went on to the meal times. First breakfast was at 7 o'clock. Then the next breakfast was at about 7:20. At 7:30, half hour bugle call to tell them that parade would start at 8 o'clock. Then a quarter hour bugle call, a quarter to 8, at 8 o'clock the fall in, and everyone started at 8 o'clock carrying out their program of training, and then that's it.
What was your first program as a bugler?
Well, we started at 6 in the morning, and then we blew the bugle calls all the way through till the 8 o'clock. Then, when we'd done the 8 o'clock programme, we would then have to go into the square at certain times. Because of the number of platoons training and the area that they're covered, and all doing different types of training, field training in the museums, down at the pictures, learning aircraft recognition, gymnasiums, people on the square. We used to be like a time clock. We would march into the middle of the square and at other designated points throughout the camp and sound the regimental call, which was Victory V, symbol of the ITC, and then 1G. Noted that was the first changeover period for people, so that the instructors and everybody knew that they couldn't go over that time, that the period had to end and people had to change into the next period. Then we would go, that would continue on till 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, the first NAFI break started for the first people on NAFI break. So we'd go out and sound the regimental call again, followed by 3 G's. That would tell them that the first NAFI break was on. Then, after a while, we'd go out at about 10:20 and sound the regimental call by 3 G's again, which meant the second NAFI people went to the NAFI for theirs, and the first people came out and went back onto the parade. Then, at 11:30, we would sound what they call half-hour dress for orderly room. That was all people that was going to be interviewed by the commanding officer. People that had come on back from courses, had just been joining the unit, people that was coming back from hospital on the Y list, and people that was going to be sentenced, or people that had serious problems at home, social problems, and so forth. Then at 11:45 we'd sound the quarter hour address for that. At 12 o'clock we sounded that, and everybody had to be on parade that was going in front of the commanding officer. We then, as buglers, started at 12:30 for our first bugle call for lunch, so that the first people into the dining room went into the cookhouse at the appropriate time for that. Then at 1 o'clock we sounded the call again for second cookhouse, and then at 1:30 we sounded a quarter hour address for all fall in. Everybody was back on the training areas or paraded and everything to carry out the program at 1:45. Then in the afternoon we carried on exactly the same, going out blowing the G's for the changeover of the periods, so that the program went along. Then at 5 o'clock We did first cookhouse again for the evening meal, and then at about 5:20, it was the second cookhouse call. 6 o'clock was defaulters, that they reported to the guard room, and the soldiers that was on defaulters in those days were then given tasks. They may have to go to the sergeant's mess to do cleaning up, they may have to dig the gardens, they may have to have polished the gongs in front of the guard room, scrub the guard room out, assist in the cookhouse, also assist in the naffies and everything. But that was on top of the normal duties. They still had to do the blancone and the boot polishing and the pressing of the uniforms and be ready for the next morning to do the parade. Then at 7 o'clock we used to play the called retreat, where the flag came down, the guard turned out, and everybody stood still while we played retreat. Then we had no more duties in the bugling line till it was 9 o'clock. Then all the defaulters again, we played defaulter call, they had to report that they finished the tasks and everything, and they were then dismissed. And at 9:30 we played what they call first post. At 10 o'clock we blew last post, where the guard turned out, and the orderly sergeants reported with the book saying who was out of barracks and who was into barracks to the guard room. At 10:15, lights out, and it was literally lights out. Everything went out in the barrack rooms and ablutions and everything out. And the company orderly sergeants, they were like the wardens, went round making sure the blackouts were up at the time and everything was in darkness at that point. Then, of course, that was the end of the soldier's day. He got his head down and dreamt of going home on leave at some time, I hope.
Can we look at the actual things that you were doing? We've mentioned bugling, of course, and you must have had to learn quite a number of calls of one kind or another. Your training, your particular training as a bugler, so how would your day go in that respect?
Well, we used to do practice. Obviously, you had to keep practicing your bugle calls and everything and that. But on top of that, we were the air defence platoon, which we did with the Bren gun in the air roll for low-flying aircraft. We also had to assist on many occasions to take over the duties from the regimental police at the guard room gate, mostly in the afternoons when we hadn't many bugle calls to play. And that was checking transport in and out, and also personnel going in and out of the main camp, who were going down either to the ADS camp or to regimental headquarters down in the castle. We also had a lot of work with the band, which was the 4th IDC band at the time, which was made up from the 1st Battalion and the 2nd Battalion, regular battalions. And we used to do quite a lot of work with Salute the Soldier, Wings for Victory Week, and morale building up, going to different factories, and also to towns to get the freedoms, and this kind of thing. And it was more or less a morale building side. We also obviously went to different military units as well, to give them concerts and to do displays, marching displays, and entertainment more or less in the military style of band and bugle marching.
In the makeup of the band, where would be the buglers?
We always marched at the front, and we played combine marches, we played bugle marches, and of course we used to blow fanfares for important dignitaries and that came, and general salutes, that was it took a lot of our time apart from the other time that we were on duty at the camp. But if you were duty bugler at the camp, well, you didn't go on the parades. That came as an important part of the organisation of running smoothing of the the battalion. Of course, you also were there available in the case of paratroops landing that, where the bugle call for the first line pickets to turn out. We had if the aircraft was going to attack the camp, we had signals to inform, a bugle call to inform everybody there was an air raid in progress. And of course, the other thing about it is, with the camp being about a quarter of a mile or so away from the headquarters down at the castle, we got numerous calls to call in certain individuals. Like, if all the sergeant majors were wanted, it would take some time to ring them round, and they may not be in their office as well as the telephone. So we'd get a call from the regimental sergeant major. He wanted to see all their sergeant majors. So we went round the camp playing the bugle call, all sergeant majors. And they used to say, come to you and say, who wants me? And just say, the RSM wants you. Or you got a report of the colonel, or officers are wanted. So you went round playing all the officers' call. So that it was a communication as well as it was a duty thing. So you had to be there 24 hours a day, dressed, to be called out at any time.
Was this dressed in your normal khaki uniform that you'd been issued with?
Oh yes, boots, gaiters, a small pack and everything in case you had to go away, and ready to move off at a minute's notice.
So you had quite a lot of calls to commit to your memory.
Well, I would think of the routine calls, I would think you would have to go around about 20, and then for individual calls on top of that, you probably, your repertoire went up to about 30, which you could use at any one time on your duty.
So you were being trained, obviously, to play these calls, and you had your bugle training, and then you'd have your training combined with the band?
That's correct, yes.
How much time a day would you assess as being the kind of periods that you spent doing this?
Well, like everybody else, we were on parade at 8 o'clock, and we'd probably go and do the bugle calls from about 8 o'clock to about 10 o'clock, and probably go over first nappy break, and I'd go back at 20 past 10, and we'd be on the square doing drill only, the band and bugles, say till about 11, a quarter past 11. Then we would probably do gymnasium, go to the gymnasium till lunchtime. Then we'd have our lunch, and then we'd parade again probably a quarter to two, and do combined marches on the square to the band and bugles. And then the band would go off and do practice their type of music, Choo Chin Chow and all the stuff, the Glenn Miller stuff that was flying about at that time. Where the buglers, we would probably go and do aircraft recognition and probably regimental history under Ted Short, who was the educational officer at the time, who later became deputy leader of the Labour Party. I think we knew more about the Beveridge Band than the Beveridge Band did at that point. But we were still there trained as soldiers, and at one time we were also involved in being first aiders, to give first aid at any given time, and the band, they more so were more expertise than we were in first aid, but we were trained as stretcher bearers. And at another point, we were taught at just over 16, some of us, to be motorcyclists, dispatch riders.
At a very busy time.
Well, they kept us fully employed, and I think that if you can just imagine the necessity to get people through training and get them into battalions, and that was most essential, and for any job which wasn't absolutely essential was given to people like us and the people that was downgraded medical.
Was there a particular drill for actually playing the bugle.
Oh, yes.
It hung from your shoulder. What was the drill after that?
Well, you put it on your hip, and then you brought it up with your the mouthpiece, obviously, to the mouth, the bell away from you, to shoulder height, and then you brought it to the front and played the call. And after you played the call, you outstretched your arm like that, and then brought the instrument down to your hip again, and you kept it on your hip, marching around the camp at all times at regimental pace. Regardless, you had you were fully dressed as a bugler, and you were dressed differently to the remainder of the people in the camp. We wore white gaiters, anklets, white web belt, and a bugle cord, and we wore a fore and aft cap, and not the berry. So you were distinguished in that sense, apart from anybody else, so that anybody looking for the bugler, he would stand out as in any, where he was in the training field or on the square or at a crossroads or in the dining hall. If someone was looking for it, he looked for it. And the police, apart from the bugle cord, they wore the same kind of, that's regimental police, wore the same kind of attire.
These bugles were quite good instruments, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Had they some kind of design or pattern?
Oh, yes, they were absolutely superb. They'd been presented to the different TA battalions by local dignitaries and townships and what have you, and by individual people. And they were quite valuable in themselves. I think we're talking about them days, the war days, where they were valued at about £200 each one. Each one was recorded, and we had special security boxes to keep them in. Of course, each individual bugler took pride in who's ever he had. If you had one from, say, Lord Barnard, or you had one from Barnard Castle School, or you had one from Spennymoor, Avon District Council, or Durham City, that was your bugle, and you looked after it. And I think today, the value of the bugles in the Silver Room is somewhere in the region of, I would think, somewhere in the region of £50,000.
Were they engraved at all?
Oh, yes, and by the people that presented them, and the ladies of Durham, the Urban Council District of Spennymoor, and people like that, Lord Londonderry, they were all engraved. And we had about 24 of these bugles in these special security boxes.
Do you recall your particular bugle?
Yes. In fact, mine was the bugle which was presented by Lord Londonderry.
And did that stay with you all of your bugling career?
While I was in Bransworth, yes, as a boy, yes.
When you did official programmes outside of the camp, which you've mentioned a number of, did you have a dress uniform, or was it still basically the uniform that you wore in camp?
Oh, no. The band, they had SD. And,
what's SD?
Well, it was the prior to the battle dress coming in, with all the buttons and fastened up there, and a peaked cap. And they used to wear a cross belt to carry the music in. And we used to have those for special occasions. And on other special occasions, where there was something of the utmost importance, both for morale side and everything, we used to be given red tunics or scarlet tunics and blue trousers and pea caps from a pool which went round the different units as they required them, but used to draw them out the pool from Catrick, And of course, you couldn't cut these things or have them tailored. So you could just imagine there was pins in them all over the place in certain times.